This is an ABC podcast.
Today on Conversations, I'm here to tell you that the world's first female rock and roll roadie has been found, and she is Australian. Tana Douglas escaped an unstable childhood to follow her love of live music in the early 70s, and she became a roadie almost by accident in 1973. Soon after, Tana joined the crew of a hard-working, up-and-coming rock and roll group called AC/DC, who treated her like a member of their extended family. From there, Tana Douglas worked for Carlos Santana and Susie Quattro. She toured with Iggy Pop around Europe and lived to tell the tale. And she was behind the desk when The Who made their triumphant return to Wembley Stadium in 1979 with AC/DC. The word roadie is a little modest, and it doesn't really cover the huge range of complex tasks that Tana has thrown herself into, from untangling cables to running the whole of the front of house sound system to climbing up into the lighting rigs. Tana has seen the very best and worst of everything a life in a touring rock and roll group can offer. Tana's memoir is called Loud, and I'm speaking to her down the line at her home in Los Angeles. Hi, Tana.
Hi, how are you?
I want to start right at the beginning of your life, because it seems like you were really cut out for this rock and roll nomad lifestyle right from the get-go. Tell me about the first time that you remember about having to leave home.
Well, that was very early on. That was very early days. I was probably about 4 years old at the time, and we pretty much did a midnight flint. We just woken up out of bed and, okay, we're leaving now. Don't wake your dad. We're out of here. He's not coming. And it was like, whoa, what's going on? You know, well, we're not happy here. Well, we thought we were happy as children, but I guess we weren't. So that was the beginning of the end for us as far as family life went. And at that young an age, you know, you have to adapt. You know, you don't know what's coming from day to day, so you just go with it.
How often did you and your sister repeat this cycle with your mum throughout your childhood?
Oh, God. You know, I've lost count. I can remember going to 11 schools. So I'm sure there's a couple that I don't remember going to or wasn't there long enough to even acknowledge that I was going there. So it was a really unusual and really quite stressful, and it was erratic. You know, that many schools in less than that many years, you know, sometimes it was two or three schools in a year, and each time meant a move.
Why did your mother feel the need to pull the plug and keep moving on like that?
You know, she wasn't a happy person. She wasn't happy in herself. She'd had, you know, a bad motor vehicle accident when she was younger. And thinking back, we think that that may have affected her, you know, and her judgment and her motor skills and various different things as far as her temperament and things like that went. So I don't think she was really well equipped to deal with much.
What was she running away from? Dangerous boyfriends or what?
I think she was running away from herself mostly. You know, looking back on it, I think that's what it was. You know, she always wanted to be someone else that she wasn't, and she would pretend to be someone that she wasn't, and eventually it would catch up with her when people had realised what she was saying wasn't necessarily completely honest, and she'd feel that she needed to get away from the situation. You know, she wasn't a person to stand her ground and justify things. It was, you know, the quiet scared her, you know, is how I look at it, that, you know, if it ever got quiet, you know, she'd always have people in the house, whether she knew them or not, which, you know, isn't a very safe environment for two young female children, you know. So eventually it became apparent to other people outside of the home that it just couldn't continue that way, and I was sent to live with my father.
What was it like to see him reappear in your life after all those years?
Well, it was scary because at the time I thought he was the person we'd been running from all those years. You know, I didn't realise she was really running from herself, you know, but we were told that it was him that she was running from. So he had a bit of a scary ogre type of presence, you know, and he was a big man. I don't know if you know the old comedian Jackie Gleason, but he was similar in physique and that. So as a small child, you're looking up at this person, and they seem like they're a giant. So it's like, oh, I guess he can be scary. But he really wasn't a scary person at all. It was just unfortunate casting, I'm afraid.
Was he happy to see you?
Well, yes, because he'd left, you know, what had left him was a sweet, innocent little four-year-old. What he got back, unfortunately, was a partially feral 11-year-old. I'm sure what he was envisaging on the plane on the way from Brisbane down to Melbourne to collect me was not what he got when he arrived.
How much solace were you getting from music at that time?
You know, it became like a talisman to me. It was, I would escape to it. I had a tiny little radio and I would lock my bedroom door and pull the blankets up over my head and listen under the pillow. It's beautiful. You know, you listen to a song, it takes you somewhere else. You know, you're in a whole different place. And if a song comes on you don't like, it's 3 minutes. You can change it or you can turn it off. Couldn't do that in the house I lived in. I couldn't just turn it all off. You know, I had to put up with whatever was going on, you know, so music was just something magic.
I remember when I got my first transistor radio when I was a little kid in the mid-late 70s, and pop singles in those days were mixed to sound good on AM radio, to sound good on a tinny transistor radio speaker.
Yeah.
And they did sound really tinny. And the signal, the songs that would come in, it felt like it was music coming in from another planet, this faraway place. Is that how it sounded to you?
Oh, it was somewhere that I wanted to go to, exactly. You know, I mean, people want to go to Narnia. I wanted to go to wherever these songs were coming from. It was a place. I mean, it was never just music over the airwaves. It was always a destination. That's where I want to be. Wherever that's coming from, that's where I want to be.
So having dropped out of school at 15, you heard the siren call of the, I think it was the Nimbin Aquarius Festival across the border in northern New South Wales.
Exactly. You know, I mean, I missed Woodstock. That devastated me at 11 years old when I missed Woodstock. It was like, what do you mean I can't go to Woodstock? Where is it? I don't know, but I want to go, you know. So that got shot down, obviously. I was the only one who didn't think it was obvious. But when Nimbin surfaced, it was like, well, I'm definitely going to this. No one's going to stop me from going to this. Whatever it is, I'm in. So I just hooked up with a bunch of people from the town square in Brisbane. You know, everyone in those days would hang out there playing music and selling candles. And I hooked up with a bunch of people and because they were going to Nimbin. It's like, yep, I'm in. That's what it was. It was just a leap of blind faith. And off we went.
You write in your book that you and everyone else in the car stopped along the way to go and pick some magic mushrooms, which you took. I just wonder what that drive to Nimbin was like once the magic mushrooms kicked in. Do you remember what that drive looked like?
It looked pretty magical to me. You know, it was a big old American car. It was a Cadillac. It had the fins and everything. And it rained on and off. So between the sun coming out and the rain, and we're in the like rainforest tropical area going up through the hills, getting up to Nimbin itself from down on the coast. And it was the first time I'd done anything. It's the first time I'd done any sort of drugs or never drank alcohol or anything like that. And it was amazing. You know, we had music playing on the radio, we'd all singing along with it. And I'm just sort of laid out with my head out the window of the back seat of the car, watching everything go by. It was really quite pleasant.
Once you arrived there and there was that big hippie rock festival on, was that your tribe? Did you think you were with your tribe, or were you not quite part of that hippie scene that was happening there at the time?
You know, I thought they were my tribe because they accepted me. It was nice to be accepted and not judged. So that, for that, I definitely thank any hippies that I came across in my early travels. It's like, I'm grateful to them because there never was any judgment. You know, there never was, well, who is she? What, she's from a private school, or how old is she? Or what does she think she's doing here? There was never any of that. I finally felt as though I was comfortable somewhere. I wasn't looking in from the outside. I was actually a part of something. And unfortunately, it was the lack of hot water, the lack of hot water, clean clothes and dry clothes and food that was a little bit deterring for me. So in the long run, it didn't pan out.
Like, what do you need a shower for when it, you know, will rain every once in a while?
Exactly. You could just drip dry. Exactly.
So you write that this is where you encountered the extraordinary French tightrope walker, Philippe Petit. Now, he's the guy who did that extraordinary stunt, walking across a cable that connected the Twin Towers, of course, when they were still up in New York City. Tell me how you were drawn into his crew to become part of one of his stunts in Sydney.
Yes, I came across him wandering around the Nimbin site. And Nimbin Festival was put on by university students, and they were given a council grant to bring Philippe Petit over to Australia as some, you know, big cultural exchange. He was up for it. He's like, oh, yeah, I'll come to your little festival in Australia. But once I'm in Australia, I get to do what I really want to do, which, of course, the government had no idea what he was thinking. They thought he was just this nice, quiet little Frenchman who was going to come over, bounce around on a piece of rope for a while and then go away again. But he had great expectations and grand schemes always. You know, I mean, he tightrope walked across Notre Dame Cathedral, all of these things, and he'd done them all under the cloak of darkness, and then all of a sudden just appeared, boom. And so, you know, he had his eyes on the entrance to Sydney Harbour Bridge. He thought that was a good thing. So, you know, I heard mention of this at Nimbin and went, well, that's, I've never been to Sydney. This will be fun. And this guy's kind of cool. He wanders around on ropes and things and cables. And this is a whole new experience. Yeah, count me in. So I just sort of tagged along, and down I went to Sydney with a group of people who were involved with the project and started putting together the whole extravaganza.
So what stunt did he have in mind for the Sydney Harbour Bridge?
Well, putting between the two, the big iconic white towers at the entrance, he strung, or, you know, what we did as a crew, they strung a steel cable across between the two. Now, I mean, this took a couple of days to do under the cover of darkness, you know, people sneaking up at night and bringing in extra cables and finding ways to rig it and getting blueprints of the bridge to see, you know, what, that it was structurally sound here, or they could use this point there. I mean, without knowing it, I was actually becoming a part of my first production.
So you're stringing up this, you're helping to string up this metal cable between those two gigantic sandstone pylons of the Sydney Harbour Bridge, and you're doing it without authorisation and without anyone finding out. And what do you remember of that day, seeing him walk across the pylons of the Harbour Bridge?
Well, I was down on the ground level, and he walked over, and then he turned and walked back, and then halfway back, he lay down on the cable. He just lay down on it. It was amazing to watch. And I mean, I remember looking up, and the sun's up, and there's all you can see is this tiny, tiny little figure, which is all dressed in black, and the shock of red hair that he had. He had this, like, carrot-top hair. And he was so petite, you know, he really was small, you know, and he had this large bar that was probably about 20-something feet long, 24 foot long, which was, I don't even know how he lifted it, let alone balanced it and stood up and laid down with it on a piece of steel cable. So my view was from the ground, and then what they did is they dropped the cans of film over the edge to us, and then we jumped down to below the bridge into a waiting car and took off. So that way we didn't get the film confiscated from the, you know, from the actual event.
So that, I suppose, prepares you for the life of a roadie, that idea you're doing something very daring that's going to get a lot of attention and requires a fair bit of can-do spirit about getting things done.
Yeah, it was exciting, you know. And he gave me my first taste of what a production is, and then took off from Sydney and ended up back. And it wasn't until I came back for a second time that I actually went to a venue and saw a real electric concert.
You fetched up in King's Cross, and this was during one of its most dangerous periods. This is after heroin had come into the Cross. How were you living at that time?
It was rough. I'd started getting too close and too comfortable with the environment, you know, and it's a dangerous environment, and you don't necessarily see it when you're that close. You know, you can be too close to see that you're getting yourself in trouble.
King's Cross turns its back on the waters of Sydney Harbour. Sleazy, grubby, neon-lit, crowded after dark with the curious, the wanderers, the pleasure-seekers. Ladies of the night, their customers.
You know, I became friends with people who were members of, like, the Sydney mob. There were girls that worked, you know, there was girls that were prostitutes on the street, and some of them were really quite young, so I kind of related to them, and you know, we'd sit and talk and hang out and stuff, you know, obviously not while they're working, but, you know, those sort of things. And you just find yourself getting completely immersed in it. And then I got to the point where all of a sudden I found myself in trouble because there was a pimp there that decided that I should be one of his working girls, and he was just going to make that happen come hell or high water. So he actually kidnapped me, really, I guess is what he did.
Now, how did he kidnap you? How did he do that?
Well, he pulled me, dragging kicking and screaming out of a restaurant that was open in the wee early hours of the morning and dragged me down the back streets of the Cross to this little dodgy bed set that he had where he lived, and just told me this was it. This was my life from now on. And I was going to be one of his working girls, and he was going to feed me on heroin and keep me under control, and whatever money I made, I would give to him.
How did you get out of that situation?
Well, basically, you know, he was a drug user himself. I'd never used anything like that. And he took a hit of heroin, and that one moment when a junkie's really high and just in their own world, that's when I decided to, like, just kick him really hard in the head and run like hell, you know? So it was like a moment of, this is the only chance I'm going to have to do this. I'm going to have to do this now, because when he comes out of this, I'm done for. He wasn't playing around. He beat his girls. He kept them high on drugs. He was a horrible, nasty piece of work. And he was also one of the King's Cross people. So, I mean, obviously no one was that upset with him because he was allowed to operate like that. You know, so I ran.
And what became of him in the end?
I believe he ended up on the bottom of Sydney Harbour Bridge, in the water, in the bay. There used to be a place where people used to go and not come back. And rumour had it that that's where he ended up, and I was really quite happy about that.
How were you introduced into the world of rock and roll stage production, Tana?
Well, what happened was, after that incident, I decided I needed to change. I needed to get out of the environment I was in. And so I moved into a flat with a couple of young girls who were nothing to do with the side of the King's Cross that I'd been dealing with. They were just these two young girls who were into music and partying and having fun. And they introduced me to the music side of the industry, where they invited me down to what was the Whiskey A Go-Go. That was the first show that I ever saw, and it was some American R&B band, and they introduced me to a couple of the crew people, and one in particular became not only a lifelong friend but also a mentor to me, and I like to laughingly say it's all his fault.
And who was that man?
That was Wayne Swampy Jarvis.
Wayne Swampy Jarvis.
That's correct. And he placed me next to the sound console. And so I'm watching these guys, you know, and what they're doing, not really figuring out that they're doing the sound. I wasn't really clear exactly what they were doing. But I was also watching these, like, there's different people would come up onto the stage with pieces of equipment or an instrument or pick up a mic stand that had fallen over. And I'm like, I wonder who those people are. What are they doing? And I mean, for all I knew, they could have been someone out of the audience, you know. I mean, I just didn't know who they were, you know. And Swampy came back to the desk at one point and said, you know, how are you doing? And I said, you know, I'm good, but who are these people? What are these people that keep coming up onto the stage, and what are they doing? And his casual response, oh, they're roadies, you know, that's their job. And that's the first time I'd ever heard the term. And it was like, oh, my God, this is really interesting. So, I mean, I spent the whole time watching them more than the band. It's funny because people say, well, it was your first show, so who was it? What band was it? No idea. No idea. I was just somewhere else. I was just too fascinated in everything else that was going on. So, I mean, I guess from that point on, it was pretty well determined that that's what I'd be doing.
Was it really? Because, I mean, you can see that and you can say, oh, that's interesting what they're doing there. But then there's another thing to think, I want to do that. What made you think I might have a crack at that?
Well, because the other thing that Swampy actually said to me was, oh, yeah, so, you know, we're going out of town. You know, we take the band down to Melbourne next. And I said, what? Wait, what? You travel as well? He said, yeah, we go all over the country. And you get paid? Yeah. And you listen to music? Yeah. Oh, okay. This is something that I really need to look into. And the first band was a band out of Melbourne called Fox. And that was, funny enough, through the girls in that flat that I moved into. One of the girls knew this band, and, you know, she wanted to go back to Melbourne. She wasn't happy and she didn't have any money. And, you know, typical young people, you know, you're always sort of moving or leaving or doing whatever. And as we're all sitting around and everyone's having drinks and chatting after the show, and it's getting later and later and no one's brought up the topic. And so finally I just go, well, hey, guys, do you think she can get a lift back with you? And Peter Laffey, actually, the guitarist for the band, he's like, oh. And he looks over at the stage and he goes, I tell you what, if these guys get out of here tonight, meaning the road crew again, She can go back with them. Otherwise, no, it's not going to happen. And I looked at the stage and they didn't look as though they were ever going to get out of there, let alone in the same evening, you know. So it's like, well, what if I give them a hand? And, of course, everyone's laughing. It's like, yeah, sure, why not, you know. And they yell over to their crew, she's going to come and give you a hand. So I just jumped in. I said, come on, you know, just. And they showed me a couple of things how to do. And then they figured out that I wasn't teetering around in high heels or anything. I had flat shoes on and jeans, and, you know, so I wasn't making a total idiot of myself. It showed me how to coil a cable, and I picked that up really quickly because there's a certain way you do these things. And they let me pack away the drum kit, and then, you know, came to loading the truck, and it's like, oh, I'll give you a hand with that. And they were quite surprised how strong I was. They're like, oh, she can actually lift stuff as well, you know.
Yeah. Tana, I played in a bunch of support bands in the early 80s and did the lug in and the lug out a couple of times, and it exhausted me much more than the gig. It might be one of the hardest, it's probably the hardest I've ever worked in my life, I think, was doing the lug in and the lug out. God, you must be a physically pretty strong person to be able to, you know, lift those bins, push them up into a truck. That is not easy work.
You know, it's not easy work, but it's also a mindset. It's as much mental as it is physical when you're lifting something that's heavy and big and cumbersome. And you've got to figure out the way to do it best and how to lift something and how to do it with momentum so you're never actually stuck with a dead weight. So it's you figure it out really quickly, or you hurt yourself really badly and never come back. And I just, and you know, I mean, nothing had been easy up until this point, so I wasn't looking for an easy out, you know what I mean? I just thought, well, if this is what they're doing, then I can do that. So that was the mentality. If they can do it, I can do it. What are they doing? Let me watch how they're doing it. Okay, I can do that.
Tana, you were the first female roadie. This is a really boring question, I know, but it's such a boys' club, rock and roll. Weren't you surrounded by guys going, oh, you're a girl, you can't do that, you're not allowed to? Was that going on?
There was quite a bit of that going on, yes. But, you know, I was lucky in the beginning because, as I briefly touched on with, you know, Swampy, he was very well-liked and very well-established in the industry. And, you know, when he found out that I'd started doing this, he just 100% supported me. And so by doing that, he actually introduced me to a bunch of, you know, the more established road crew people at the time who, you know, some of them still to this day are touring down in Australia. So when the higher up accept you, it's pretty difficult for others to sort of undermine that, although they did try. I mean, you know, it's an instinctual thing. You know, men don't like being shown up by a woman or their sacred areas being traversed by a young girl. It's like it was a bit of a sacrilege, I'm sure, to some, but to others it was like kind of entertaining, and others it was just didn't care one way or another.
I suppose for all the men who want to keep it a boys' club, there are plenty of men too who actually find the presence of a woman in an all-male sort of situation a real relief.
Yeah, there is that. Some you're like the shoulder to cry on, you know, if they break up with their girlfriend or whatever, you know. Others, it's like, can you give me some tips? You know, why don't women like me? You know, as you're saying, keep away from me. What are you doing? Stop it. And others who just want to see if they can drink you under the table and take advantage of you. Unfortunately, I could outdrink pretty much anybody, so that never really went well for the person trying it. they'd usually end up in a crumpled heap on the floor somewhere drooling. So saying the next morning, what did she do? My God, don't try and outdrink her.
But you're also surrounded by some of the horniest people on the face of the planet as well. I mean, I suppose you have to figure out pretty quickly about what you want to do about that and how you're going to handle that.
Yeah, you know, it is. It's a pretty machismo environment. And in those days, the only women that did come into the backstage area were really there to meet the band member or try and get close to somebody famous or whatever. So there was always that fine line where I'd really got nervous about, you know, I don't want people thinking I'm here for that reason. So I'd go pretty much extremely to the other side. Like, I'd dress like the guys, I'd talk like the guys, I'd swear like the guys and get in just as much trouble as them. And I think that's kind of why they adopted me. I think they saw me as this little stray waif that was just kind of feisty and not bad, you know, quite fun to have around, really.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Podcast, broadcast, and online.
So 1974, you're still 17 at this point, by the way, I should add. Tell me how you were introduced to AC/DC.
Yes, I was still working for Fox at the time. I had moved to Melbourne, so that went all really well. And I got approached by, you know, one of the major booking agents / managers down in Melbourne, Australia, and he pulled me aside. We'd go into Mushroom House, which was Michael Gudinski's, you know, very early on. It was the start of the Mushroom Empire. And Premier Artists was the main booking agency in there at the time. And we go in on Mondays and everyone would pick up the worksheets for the week so we'd know what gigs we had coming up that week. So anyway, he approached me and said, you know, have you ever thought of working for a different band, you know? And I said, well, why? He said, well, you know, you might want to think about it. You know, I'm not sure this band's going to be around for that much longer as they are. And you probably want to be working for someone else before they break up. Otherwise, you're going to be out of a gig. Ooh, never really thought of that. So that was a little scary to me. It's like, wow, I didn't never thought of that. I just presumed everything would keep on going nicely as it was. So I went up to his office and he said, well, if you're interested, I'll introduce you to my partner, who was Michael Browning, who became the sole manager eventually of AC/DC. So, you know, I met with Michael and he said, well, if you're up for it, the boys are in town. We've just got them a house. They're going to be moving to Melbourne. And we want everyone to live in this house so they're all together and we know where everyone is. Come over and meet them and see what they think.
And what was AC/DC at that point in terms of where they were as a band and in the public eye?
Well, at that point, you know, they'd done a few shows. You know, they were based in Sydney. They'd done a few shows and they'd even done a couple of shows in, like, Adelaide. And I think they'd done one show in Melbourne, which is where Browning originally saw them. But they'd broken up. The manager, it had fallen apart. I think they went over to Perth and all of a sudden that the shows weren't what they thought they were going to be. There was no money. There was no nothing. They couldn't get anything and equipment working. And, you know, they didn't like the lead singer they had at the time. And it just all fell apart. And they called Michael. So what happened from that breakup was there were the two brothers, young. So there was Malcolm and Angus. They were the core of the band. And they just brought on Bon Scott to replace their old singer. And that's who there was at the time. You know, they didn't have Phil yet. They didn't have Mark Evans yet or Phil Rudd.
Was there that family atmosphere that you noticed right at the get-go?
Very much so. Very close, very tight, and very caring for each other, always looking out for each other, got each other's backs. And I think that could have been part of the reason. I never asked them, but I think that could have been part of the reason of having a female, was that, you know, they had sisters and they had a family environment that they were used to. They were young, you know, they weren't a lot older than me. Angus is only a year older and Malcolm's like 3 years older. And I think it was trying to give them a comfort level as well, where it felt a bit more like a family environment. So, you know, I don't know for sure, but I think that may have had something to do with them being open to the fact of hiring a female.
We had FIFA Riccobono on the show not so long ago.
I love FIFA.
Yeah, FIFA's amazing. It seems like they wanted women around them because they actually liked women. I mean, you can't say that of every band, can you?
You know, I think what it is they had good role models growing up. You know what I mean? So, you know, they had strong women in their family. Their mum was very well respected and adored. So what are they going to do? Of course they're going to appreciate women and respect women.
I love this. I love this, Tana. The band wanted your mother's permission for you to join them on tour. How did they go out getting your mother's permission for you to join the group?
Well, you know, I think they just wanted to make sure it was, you know, because they knew I was young. But and another thing, I don't think anyone ever knew how young I was, you know, because I think that may have been a problem at the time. But they knew I was young, but and at the time I was back living with my mother. So they said, you know, is she going to be all right with you moving into a place full of guys? Yeah. I mean, she couldn't wait to see the back of me. She was well happy, you know, but I wasn't going to quite tell them that, you know, and I said, well, sure, you know, and I figured, you know, what young band starving is going to turn down a free meal, you know, so, she cooked up this huge meal for everybody, and, you know, Bond got to run around the place acting like like himself, chatting her up and arm around her and, you know, winking at her and everything.
Bond Scott was chatting up your mother?
Well, just to wind me up, you know, because I was just squirming. I was mortified. It's like, oh, my God, you know. And, yeah, so, you know, he's just such a joker, you know, such a practical joker. It was like, oh, my God. Plus, you know, that way she'd see what a wonderful boy he was. And everyone's parents thought Bond was just such a wonderful boy.
Was that a musical education for you, living amongst those guys?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And you know, I learned so much because the equipment was there. We'd rehearse in one of the front rooms constantly. There was rehearsals going on. They were always wandering about with their instruments, even showing me and helping me. I mean, I'd learned how to restring guitars, but these were electric guitars, you know, with pickups and all these different things. So they were different instruments than what I was, you know, totally 100% used to. I mean, I'd had a crash course with the band Fox, but this was obviously taking it to the next level. And I learned a lot. Yeah, of course I did.
This was the time when Angus was still trying to evolve a persona. Did you watch the evolution of Angus Young into that naughty rock and roll schoolboy stage persona?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, he was quite shy, you know. He was quite a shy person and wasn't that social animal that he became, you know. I mean, he was quiet. He kept to himself. He'd go into his room, you know, and he'd just play his guitar for hours and hours and hours. Kudos to Malcolm. He knew from the beginning that he needed Angus to have as strong a position in the band as he had, and by making him a predominant character in the band, that would solidify his position. I mean, not that his musical talent wouldn't do that on its own, but to make it something that was indisputable, then that was the move. That was the move. Create a personality, create a persona. And he already had the schoolboy uniform. That thing had already been started and he tried it, but it wasn't 100% of the time used. So, you know, there were different little variations, whether they were the little prison outfits or a Superman outfit at one point he wore, you know. So there was different playing with the costumes, but there was always a costume thing involved. And I think that was like his defense mechanism. He was stepping into a persona, and that way he could be as wild as he wanted. And it obviously worked.
This was when they'd began to release their album, High Voltage, which is, you know, one of the all-time great classic rock and roll albums, without a doubt. How hard did the band work that year? Tell me about what it was like to be on the road with them and watch the crowds grow and the interest in them start to mount and surge.
Well, it was amazing. The first few months, people are like, what is this? You know, you'd get, you know, whether you're doing a show in Ringwood and there's Sharpies or whatever, or, I mean, they were rough crowds. They were rough audiences. We'd get to do school shows as well, which was great, but you couldn't pick and choose your venues. You'd be doing an ice rink one night. You'd be doing three pub gigs the next night. You'd be in a town hall somewhere and you were just all over town. And whether it was down to Geelong, you know, then you started spreading out further. You know, we had this belt that we worked. And we do, within a very short amount of time, especially, you know, once we got both Phil and Mark on board, we were up to sometimes 14 shows in a week. I mean, it was outrageous the amount of work that we did. We just didn't have any time off. There was no time off. And, you know, I mean, fair enough, Michael Browning had invested money into them. He was paying for the house. He was paying for whatever they needed with their equipment. He was paying for the studio. We were getting, you know, a nominal wage, but I mean, at the time it was like, woohoo, $60, I'm in. And I don't live at home with my mum, I'm in. Sign me up.
So then you graduated from backline roadie, which is, you know, cable wrangling on stage, to sound engineer, front of house, an absolutely critical job. And this was thought to be a newsworthy thing. How was this pitched to the media, the idea that there was a woman doing front of house sound, Tana?
I'm still embarrassed to this day. I actually swore I'd never do an interview again after that, and it's taken me almost 40 years. So there you go. That's how shell-shocked I was. The manager came up with the idea, Browning, and said, you know what we should do? We should get the Age newspaper down to take a photo of you doing a load-in or something, you know, and we can use that as publicity for the boys. And I said, no, that's a terrible idea. It should all be about the band. And they didn't have any of it. They thought it was hilarious and I should do it. But instead of me unloading the truck or setting up the sound gear on stage or whatever, they decided that what they'd do is have me take one microphone stand, past the truck full of equipment, round the corner to a car, open the back door and have my photo taken placing a microphone stand in the back of a passenger car. And then when it came out in the newspaper, the headline was, "She does it for the band." Oh, God.
Oh. Oh, nice. Oh, that's so really classy, isn't it? Oh, that very nice. And I suppose the band thought that was hilarious.
Oh,
too,
yeah.
You know?
Oh, it was a great joke. Mm. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You must have been furious.
Let's leave copies of this lying all around the house just to really upset
nice.
It.
Oh, that's lovely, isn't it? So, yeah, so you've been a bit gun shy of the media ever since, and no wonder. Tell me how you got to meet Malcolm and Angus's mum, the matriarch of the young clan from Scotland.
Well, what had happened is they'd finished recording the album and we were set to go to Sydney for the first time since they'd really moved out of home. And we were going to go up and do, you know, amongst other shows, we were going to do 4 nights at the Bondi Lifesaver, which was a huge thing. You know, it was a big deal at the time. And we had 2 days before the show started, and that gave Malcolm and Angus a chance to catch up with their family. You know, they were returning the conquering heroes, which was wonderful for them. You know, they'd done a lot of hard work in a very short amount of time. They had an album that was selling. They had singles shooting up the charts. So they were the conquering heroes, you know, and it was such a wonderful moment in their history, actually, from very early on. And Malcolm just asked me, he said, "Look, we're going to stay at the house in Burwood. Do you want to come and stay with us instead of going to the hotel?" And it was like, oh, you know, that'd be lovely, yeah. So that was a really sweet gesture. So I peeled off with Malcolm and Angus and to the house, and they got me all settled in there. I had a little room and stuff, and met all the family, you know, because all the family turned up to meet them and congratulate them. And it was just a wonderful moment. And that was, you know, the time that I got to meet their mum.
And so where were you taken to meet her?
Oh, upstairs to the bedroom, yeah. She was in her bed at the time. She'd had some different ailments, and so she was sort of resting and not really out and about at that time. I think Margaret took me upstairs and sat me next to her at the bed and said, "There you go, you know, our mum wants to have a chat. She wants to say hi, you know, see who's staying in the house." And Margaret disappears, and there's me and the mum. And, you know, she was just such a sweet, wonderful person. It was a bit awkward because she had an incredibly thick Scottish accent and I was having a lot of difficulty understanding what she was saying, and I was kind of a little scared to answer in case I was like mishearing her and not sure what she would say. So I was a bit terrified to make a total idiot of myself. But apart from that, it was just a wonderful experience.
Being on the road with AC/DC, this is not a well-known thing, but Angus Young was and is a teetotaler, doesn't drink. That wasn't Bon Scott, though. That wasn't Bon Scott at all. What was the biggest scare Bon gave you while on tour?
Yeah, you know, Bon had demons even that early on, you know, which is unfortunate. And I think he had this fear of his age being older. He was a good 10 years older than everybody else. And, you know, I think that played on him quite a bit weight-wise, you know, mentally. He had problems with his voice, actually, you know, because we were working so hard. I mean, he didn't have a chance to recuperate, you know. We're doing 10, 12, 14 shows in a week. I mean, he would use a mixture of port and honey to soothe his vocal cords. But, you know, after a while, that didn't even work. So, you know, he hooked up with a couple of people he'd known from the past, a couple of girls, sisters, and started doing some drugs that he probably shouldn't have been doing. And it went badly one night. We all got woken up in the house that Bon had stopped breathing and the girl couldn't get him to wake up. And it was scary. It was a very scary time.
And what happened when you got into the room where Bon was? What did you see?
Well, Bon was there and he looked incredibly peaceful and calm, and I felt a bit weird being in his room because I never really went into his room, you know, and I'm trying to wake him up and we've called an ambulance, we've got the girls out of there and everyone's panicking, and it's like, well, what are we going to do? And so...
Was he breathing at the time?
Well, I don't think so. It didn't seem as though he was, so, you know, I did try mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, I did try CPR, and then one of the people came into the bedroom, Angus's girlfriend at the time, and she's like, "What's going on?" I said, "I don't think he's breathing." And we're freaking out. Everyone's freaking out. No one knows what to do. I mean, we're still a bunch of young kids, you know. So, I mean, I just slammed him really hard on the chest because CPR didn't seem to be working. And I'd learned CPR at school. You know, I was a swimmer at school, so I thought I knew what I was doing, but it wasn't working. So as a last-ditch thing, I slammed him really hard on his chest. And as I did that, then the medics arrived, you know, the ambulance guys. And They said, well, you did the right thing. I mean, I was scared I'd probably killed him. I thought, Jesus Christ, this will be my fault now. I've killed him. You know, it's like, I don't know what to do. But luckily, it seemed to be the right thing to do. And they arrived in time that they could keep him breathing and get him off to the hospital. So, you know, that was a disaster averted and something that at the time we never discussed it. It was never discussed, and it wasn't discussed for years and years and years afterwards, and not until long after his death was it ever discussed.
With AC/DC becoming such a huge band very suddenly, there were plenty of girl fans trying to get to the band for whatever reason. How did those fans respond to the presence of a female roadie, your presence in the crew?
Yeah, that was when the fan base moved from all males to a lot of young female girls. My job got a lot harder. For some reason, I was this horrible person that was keeping the band away from all their female fans. I don't know how that logic took effect, and I don't know. I don't understand it still to this day, but it was like, you know, the girls get hysterical when they see a girl there where they want to be, and it's just, they've got to get rid of her. You know, I mean, I got attacked, I got punched, I got things thrown at me.
What were they calling you? What were they shouting at you as they were punching and attacking you?
I don't know if I could say it on the radio.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the nicest thing I ever got called was an effing bitch. You know, I mean, there it just got worse. You know,
so that was the launch point, was it?
That's where the bar started, and it only went up from there. So yeah, and to be honest, it did start bothering me. So it was part of the reason that it all sort of came to an end.
Yeah, well, suddenly the band were huge, next level, playing seriously big venues. Why did you think it was then time to go?
Well, I hadn't had anyone who could teach me anything for the whole time I was with them, because we were just working nonstop and doing what we did. You know, I mean, I started doing sound without so much as one lesson. No one even showed me how to set up the PA system, really. You know what I mean? It was just thrown in a truck and, oh, by the way, now that's your job. Well, what do you mean it's my job? I do backline. No, but you're going to do sound now because you know what the band wants.
That's mad. That's incredibly mad. You never got trained? You just had to figure out on your own?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And to make it worse, we're doing monitors as well as front of house sound from the same desk.
So that means if the foldback isn't right, the band is just like making frantic gestures to you from the stage.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, and not a good position to be in. But you know, luckily, I mean, they were quite clear with their direction, and I did know what they wanted. So you know, at the time, it worked. They were happy. They could trust that even though they obviously couldn't hear what was happening off the stage, they could trust that I had their back and was giving them the best sound that they could get.
And as the roadie, what was it like for you to watch Angus Young climb up onto the Marshall stacks and the PA bins that you've lovingly assembled and put on stage? Was that slightly terrifying?
Oh, it was totally terrifying because, you know, it'd be my fault if it all collapsed and killed him. You know, irrelevant that we've said, don't climb on that today, it's really unstable. That didn't mean anything. It was like, yeah, right, okay. And it's like, no, you don't understand.
Yeah, this could be a very different interview today. Like today I'm talking to Tana Douglas, who set up the PA that Angus Young toppled from and died from.
Yeah, that girl that killed Angus.
Just when they're on the brink of success.
Yeah, all my fault.
So you wanted to learn some new stuff and you thought it was time to go. How do you now reflect back on that time that you spent living with the band in St Kilda and watching them become the gigantic international phenomenon that is now AC/DC?
You know, I look back on it with really tender memories, you know what I mean? I mean, I love the boys. It's like, I really do. And you know, it just stayed with me. You know, they taught me an incredible work ethic. And the time that I was with them, I felt that they had my back and I had their back. And it was just a really safe environment for a young girl to be in at the time. And I thank them for that. I really do. And that's why probably to this day, I've always got a soft spot in my heart for them.
Broadcast, podcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
Today I'm with Tana Douglas. This is the first of a two-part conversation with her. Tana is the first female rock and roll roadie, and she's the author of a memoir called Loud. Tana got her start as a touring roadie with AC/DC, went out into the world and acted as a road manager, as a sound desk operator, as a lighting rig operator for acts like The Who at Wembley Stadium, for Neil Diamond, Susie Quattro, Status Quo, Ozzy Osbourne, and yes, Iggy Pop. We're going to pick up the conversation tomorrow with Tana, and you'll hear the story of her amazing life going on the road all over the world with these artists. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Hey there. If you love hearing the stories of extraordinary women, can I suggest another great ABC podcast? It's called Fierce Girls, and it takes you to a world of amazing Australian women. The trailblazers who had a determination to make history. Strong and inspiring female role models? We've got them. Fierce Girls, on the ABC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts.